This is Ozarks at Large for Wednesday, November 9th, 2011. I'm Kyle Kellums.
And I'm Antoinette Grajeda. In a moment, Michael Tilley from thecitywire.com talks to Kyle about yesterday's rejection of a 1% prepared food sales tax in Fort Smith. And we'll hear the four voices that make up the a cappella group 540 Express. The Fayetteville Public Library will host an evening with author Geraldine Brooks on Sunday, November 13th, beginning at 7 p.m. Brooks will be discussing her novel March, which won her the Pulitzer Prize in Fiction in 2006. More information regarding this free event and book signing is available on the web at faylib.org.
We begin this edition of Ozarks at Large with the results of yesterday's off-year election. Statewide, voters approved the dedication of an already existing 4-cent diesel tax for interstate rehabilitation by a wide margin. In Fort Smith, voters going to the polls rejected a long-debated 1% prepared food sales tax by a 2-to-1 margin. Michael Tilley, the editor and publisher of thecitywire.com, has been covering the sales tax discussion since the beginning, and he's with me on the phone from his office in Fort Smith. Michael, you last week on this program predicted that it would not probably succeed, and...
Well, I'm not surprised that it went down. I'm surprised at the margin. I mean, that in political terms, that is that's a big loss for the city. It'll be interesting how they... It'll be interesting how they recover from this. And budget meetings start tomorrow night, in fact, to prepare for 2012. And so the city is going to have to find at least $800,000 in a general fund budget that's already tight, if not beyond tight. So we've got a lot of decisions to make in the next few months on how we're going to fund the convention center and to what extent.
Have there been any hints? Do you think there's been a contingency plan that where that $800,000 might come from if what happened last night at the polls happened?
Well, the city did a couple of months ago and put out a Plan B report. Of course, they took a lot of heat from it because they essentially said, you know, we're going to have to cut. I think they proposed around $315,000 from the police department. A little over $200,000 from the city parks department, probably cut around $200,000 from what's called an outside agency fund, where they help local charities primarily help them, you know, pay utility bills so they can, you know, Boys and Girls Club type things, feed the poor type things. So they'll probably cut that. Now, the opponents of the tax call that scare tactics, but. And maybe it was, but when the general fund budget, when 60% of that general fund budget is made up of these critical services, it's hard to cut and not cut some of those services.
It seems like everybody has said now in the hours since the polls closed and the results have been known that everyone wants the convention center to keep operating.
Right. You know, and I'm sure there'll be some better analysis even by me in the future. I think my initial thinking, and this could change, but my initial thinking is that the city has been so ham-fisted in its approach toward this, going on for now 3 years. They didn't bring in groups to discuss it. I mean, I've told folks before that I want to write a how not to run an election book, and I'm going to use this whole example to write the book. I mean, the book will almost write itself, but you know, they didn't bring people in. They didn't have a grassroots get out the vote campaign. All of the drama associated with this petition that eventually went to the court and the city lost its court case to put this on the ballot. You know, I talked to a lot of people in my circles who said they support, they don't have a problem with the 1% prepared food tax. They support the convention center. They just wanted to send a message to the city that this is not how you conduct business. That's a little bit, you know, the classic cut your nose off, spot your face problem, but I hear some of that. And Kyle, the other thing I hear is, well, this was just a general anti-tax mood pervasive now around many parts of the country. And here's why I reject that argument. Let's look in Clarksville, Arkansas, just down the road, near where I grew up. They approved three different issues supported by a 1-cent sales tax extension. They're going to build an aquatic center. That received 61% of the vote. They extended the sales tax also to fund police station improvements, 60% of the vote, and to extend the sales tax for fire station improvement. That's 65% of the vote. Lowell approved a 1-cent city sales tax extension with 81% of the vote. Benton down in central Arkansas The last I checked, it approved overwhelmingly a 1.5% prepared food tax extension to build a convention center. So to simply blame this on an anti-tax, anti-government mood, I think is I think it's short-sighted, and it fails to recognize what happened around the state last night.
There was at least one other rejection. I know in Boone County, a sales tax proposal went down. I think 86% said
right. No. Well, in North Little Rock lost a couple sales tax extensions, for items. I think that's the point. Yes, there are other things that went down, but looking at just those three communities that I mentioned earlier, I think it vacates any notion that there's just overwhelming anti-tax, anti-government mood in Arkansas.
Now, Fort Smith, sometime perhaps in 2012, perhaps in March, we'll be talking about an extension of a tax to help the Fort Smith Fire Department. Do you think there's any residual influence from this to that?
Well, I think I would be foolish not to think so. It'll be interesting to see if the city board of directors and top city staff learned any lessons about how they approach the public, especially in terms of educating them about the need and tying the revenue back to them, how it really relates to them. And I think those are things they failed to do on the 1% prepared food tax. But yes, I mean, here we go again. You know, the roller coaster doesn't stop. But part of that tax will be to extend or to continue improvements on this wet weather sewer system problems we have that the Department of Justice is requiring us to fix. And within that, they'll probably ask for roughly just a little over $8 million in fire station improvements, a new fire station in Chaffee Crossing, and upgrades to existing buildings and equipment.
Finally, in full disclosure, the City Wire had an editorial urging voters to approve this sales tax. What was the motivation behind that?
Well, we followed, as you know, and we've talked about it for years now. We followed this issue for a long time. We've looked at how other cities conduct this. It's a common tax. It's not by any means, to call it a tax too is almost, I know it's a game of semantics, but it's more of a fee. If you don't eat out, you're not paying it. And we also noted in our editorial that there was an ad hoc committee back in 2010 that looked at this issue, and they looked at the 1% prepared food tax. They looked at a third-party operator. They looked at reinstituting a business license fee. Kyle, they looked at all kinds of options on what was the best way to fund the operations of the convention center. And this is a group of private sector business people. And through all of that, they came back and said, you know, the 1% is the easiest, it's the most painless, it's the most common, and it's the best way that would allow Fort Smith to compete with other cities its size or larger in the recruitment of conventions to the city. So that was the basis for our argument.
Michael Tilley is the editor and publisher of thecitywire.com that covers politics, business, and more for the Fort Smith region. Michael, thank you.
Hey, thanks for talking to us, Kyle.
Scientists have finally determined what's killing large populations of hibernating bats across the eastern half of the United States. The disease has not yet been documented in Arkansas, but caves on federal and state lands will remain closed until further notice. Ozarks at Large's Jacqueline Froelich reports.
The disease is called white nose syndrome. It's a white powdery substance which coats the muzzles and wings of hibernating bats, rousing them from torpor in the dead of winter. They end up burning critical fat reserves, and some even venture out to feed, where they either freeze to death or starve. Federal wildlife authorities say certain little brown bat populations infected with white nose syndrome have declined as much as 97%. More than 1 million bats have perished so far. White nose syndrome was first discovered in caves near Albany, New York, by the New York State Department of Environmental Conservation in the winter of 2007. Since then, scientists have struggled to secure funding to study the disease. Congress eventually approved $1.9 million to research the cause of white nose syndrome. And finally, last month, scientists with the U.S. Geological Survey National Wildlife Health Center in Madison, Wisconsin, confirmed the cause of white nose syndrome, a fungus called Geomyces destructans. Scientists kept healthy little brown bats in cold confinement for 100 days and exposed them to the fungus. They developed white nose syndrome. Here's David Blair, U.S. Geological Survey microbiologist and an author of this study, providing comment on a USGS podcast.
This study was conducted based on a strict medical or pathology definition for white nose syndrome, based upon observation of a characteristic skin lesion caused by Geomyces destructans. And based upon this definition, we were able to cause white nose syndrome in 100% of the bats that we infected.
Scientists also discovered the disease is spread through bat-to-bat transmission. They suspect white nose syndrome originated in European bat caves called hibernaculum, but populations there are not affected by the fungus. Scientists believe that's likely because European bats are larger and environmental conditions may be different. But white nose syndrome is spreading rapidly in the United States, in part due to mechanical transmissions, for example, by cavers picking up spores on their boots. That's why U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has recommended universal precautions, restricting access to many caves.
We know that the fungus grows on bats exuberantly. In doing so, it's rapidly multiplying and making more of itself and more infectious units in the form of spores. And so if you have a cave with thousands of bats, there's great potential for the fungus to amplify and grow and infect more animals.
Geomyces destructans thrive only in specific cold and damp conditions, so humans, pets, and other wildlife are not at risk for contracting the disease. White nose syndrome has been documented so far in 13 states in the Northeast, Mid-Atlantic, and Midwest, and in two Canadian provinces, Ontario and Quebec. The presence of the fungus has also been confirmed in Missouri and Oklahoma, but so far not in Arkansas. Chuck Bidding is a geologist with the National Park Service stationed on the Buffalo National River Park.
Well, in approximately July of 2009, we closed nearly all of the 360 caves on Buffalo National River because of our concern about white nose syndrome and the potential of what was, at that time, it was believed that the fungus was the cause of the disease, but it wasn't proven.
The National Park Service ordered Buffalo National River Park to close its caves because it's the most cave-rich unit on the national park system. That same year, U.S. Forest Service agents also closed more than 800 caves in Arkansas. Devil's Den State Park also shut down its caves to recreationists. Now that scientists know the cause of white nose syndrome, they can work to combat the spread of the disease using experiments on bats in a laboratory setting. But in the meantime, all cave closures will remain in effect to protect bat colonies here.
Bats are extremely important. In the Ozarks, bats are the primary predator for night-flying insects. And, you know, a lot of people think mosquitoes, and mosquitoes are a nuisance to us, and actually they are a health threat to humans and our dogs and our livestock and wildlife, but also insects like moths. Moths are night flyers, and they cause a lot of damage to crops and even forest resources. So bats eat these things at night, and they eat huge numbers of them. A colony of bats, 100 bats, can eat a lot of insects every evening.
One flock of 150 bats can consume up to 1 million insects a year. Bats are critical to the protection of our fruits and vegetable crops. By feasting on noxious pests like stink bugs, leafhoppers, and cucumber beetles, one published study valued bat bug predation nationwide at $3.7 billion annually. Wildlife biologists in Arkansas are monitoring any incursion for white nose syndrome.
As of now, to my knowledge, there have been no reports of white nose syndrome on any bats in Arkansas. There have been a few cases where bats appeared suspicious, but they have not proved out to be affected with white-nose syndrome.
But the question is, why have bats here not contracted the disease?
I don't know, and I hate to speculate, but I will say that sometimes I think that it's just perhaps being in the, you know, the right place, the right time. That we may be spared, or we may not be spared. We may just not realize it, because our surveys of bat caves are not. They're not totally comprehensive, and each year we don't survey every bat cave because we want to spread the impact of the surveys out over a couple of years and not hit all of them each year, because that every time we survey a bat cave in the winter, it causes impact to that colony. And if we did that year after year after year, it would probably cause mortality in the colony just from the disturbance. So there's a lot of colonies that don't get inspected each year, surveyed each year, and it could be that, or it could be that my hope is we're far enough south that the hibernation period's short enough for the bats that the fungus never really gets a good foothold.
USGS concurs with this suspicion, saying that high mortality has not been reported as the disease moves west. So climate conditions may impede white-nose syndrome here. In Arkansas, we have 16 species of bats, and the Ozark Highlands contain thousands of caves and fissures, critical habitat for the rare Ozark big-eared bat, as well as the endangered gray and Indiana bats. National Park Service geologist Chuck Bidding advises hikers who come across any distressed bats near any caves in the Ozarks to contact authorities.
Actually, if they see a bat floundering in the winter outside of a cave, they should probably either call the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service Conway Field Office. I don't have the phone number just off the top of my head. Or contact the Arkansas Game and Fish Commission, and they have a bat biologist who can also assist, but they should not handle the bat. They should not pick up the bat. They should try to contact someone so that tissue samples or whatever can be sent off to the various labs that are working on this white-nose syndrome problem.
Protecting bats is critical. Even though they can live for several decades, an average female bat breeds only one pup per year. And according to the U.S. Geological Survey, half of all U.S. bat species hibernate in caves and mines. So far, 7 species have been affected. Reporting for Ozarks at Large, I'm Jacqueline Froelich.
To learn more, you can visit fws.gov/white-nose syndrome. And in about 2 minutes on Ozarks, sprucing up a bit of Ozark history. An 8mm film made nearly 50 years ago to save the Buffalo River from being dammed is being remastered and saved digitally. How Dr. Neil Compton's plea to save the buffalo will survive in 90 seconds on Ozarks at Large.
Earth, sky. Wednesday, November 9th. Given clear skies, everyone around the world will see the planet Jupiter near the moon tonight.
You can't miss Jupiter because this dazzling world is the third brightest object to light up the nighttime after Venus and the moon. Venus sets in early evening, so Jupiter and the moon are the brightest objects up nearly all night tonight.
You'll find the moon and Jupiter low in the east at dusk and nightfall. As evening deepens into late night, watch for the moon and Jupiter to climb upward. They'll soar highest in the sky in the middle of the night and descend westward in the wee morning hours after midnight. They'll set in the west at or near the break of Thursday's dawn.
The moon and Jupiter move westward for the same reason that the sun moves westward across the sky during the day. It's because Earth rotates from west to east on its axis. Jupiter is the fifth planet outward from the sun. It's truly a giant of a planet, with more than twice the mass of all the other solar system planets, moons, and asteroids combined. 1,000 of our planet Earths could fit inside Jupiter.
Once you see the almost full waxing gibbous moon this evening, it'll be hard to miss the giant planet Jupiter. It'll be that bright and beautiful star-like object near the moon. Watch for it. I'm Jorge Salazar.
And I'm Deborah Bird. We have daily sky info at our website, earthsky.org. EarthSky is a clear voice for science.
We're at earthsky.org.
The National Film Preservation Foundation has awarded a grant worth nearly $4,600 to the University of Arkansas Libraries to remaster, preserve, and digitize a nearly 50-year-old 8mm film produced by Dr. Neil Compton. Janet Parsh, the assistant to the head of special collections, explains the 14-minute documentary titled Opportunity for Arkansas, the Buffalo National River, is one of 13 films included in the Neil Compton papers, which are held in the special collections department.
He developed these films, these 13 films, in his little dark room at home, which is now at the Compton Gardens building. And he put them together. He did the filming of them. He knew music enough that you can hear on some of the films that he's actually plunking down the needle onto the LP. He's got Wagner going in the background. He has Smetana going in the background. The Moldau here and these little excerpts of the Buffalo River. He narrates them. We have in the Neil Compton papers and the Ozark Society papers the scripts. Handwritten scripts and typewritten scripts, and it turns out that he had these available to go out to garden clubs or civic clubs or anybody who was interested to see and learn a little bit more about the whole Buffalo River campaign to have it be designated as a national river.
Compton was a physician in Bentonville, as well as the founding president of the Ozark Society. This organization led the campaign to keep the Buffalo River in North Arkansas from being dammed. In 1972, federal legislation resulted in the designation of the Buffalo as America's first national river.
One of the key things is that people saw that several different dams were being built in the White River, throughout northern Arkansas and southern Missouri. And I think that they came to the conclusion, why have every last river be dammed? That the Buffalo River was special for its scenery, for the feel of what it is, and that there was one river that they could leave in its pristine form. Obviously, if you look through the papers that are there, and you read his book, you read the newspapers, you read the other accounts. A controversial setting, and it was something that was real upsetting to a lot of people. I think that the idea that there is a national river there now is also something to take into account. A lot of people feel that Neil Compton was a key conservationist in Arkansas.
To help with the preservation of the 1963 film, the documentary has been shipped to a film processing company in Hollywood. Thanks to the grant, university libraries can afford to have the film completely remastered.
They will remaster it as a 16mm film. The technology for 16mm is still much more reliable for the long term, and so they will do. That's one of the things that they'll do. They will also clean the film. They will also put it through what they call a wet gate process, and it puts it sort of into a chemical bath that would remove any of the scratches and sort of take care of any of the deterioration that's occurred from actually having used the film. They will also convert it to a digital beta cam, which makes it possible to actually broadcast it. If the Larry Foley's of the world were to ever do documentaries on this, it could be ready immediately for higher level processing in a commercial film, for example.
Parsh explains the films were kept in pretty good shape in the Compton home until Compton's children donated them to the library following his passing in 1999. However, 8mm film can become more fragile over time, so it's important to find ways to preserve it.
They do say that this is to remaster is sort of the gold standard, that if there were all the money in the world to be able to preserve our history this way, it would be the way to go. So, but obviously that's not the case.
University libraries submitted two films for the grant. Parsh says Opportunity for Arkansas was one of their choices for a number of reasons.
There's scenery in it. There's canoeing. There's also the bulldozer impact there. It shows reservoirs, the Beaver Lake Reservoir, that or Table Rock also, I gather, is, was some of what he filmed. There's also, like, maps of the Lone Rock Dam site, just to have the flavor of what kinds of media and materials were being used in the 60s. To promote one side or another is really quite fascinating. He's narrating it, so you have that record as well of his voice.
Parsh says this film gives a general flavor of the landscape, as well as the issues surrounding the damming of the Buffalo River.
It's very interesting to see. It's fun. There are canoers out there. There are people hiking, especially with the drama of the music and the script in the background. There are bulldozers out that are actually clearing the land for the reservoir that Beaver Lake created, or that Beaver Dam created. There's scenery at Montanay with these bulldozers from the 60s or whenever they were built that's out there. So it's trying to make the point about what happens when you have dams and the reservoirs that are created and, you know, the land that's taken up for the dams. So they were promotional films to sort of explain what the situation was and what would be lost in terms of the beauty and the environment if the Buffalo were to be dammed.
Given that these promotional films were distributed before internet and email existed, Parsh says the results of the campaign were impressive.
With these films being sort of a promotional, when you think about the advertising and the TV and everything that's available, that somebody in an amateur home movie environment took the time and learned into it how to do this is one thing. The other part that you see from the papers is what that really meant for a grassroots volunteer organization. To have these communications going back and forth by letter. I mean, the record is there. You know, there aren't emails deleted because email didn't exist at the time. And for the time that it took for the back and forth, the civility that's there in the writing, and just that whole process of bringing several states actually together in on this is quite remarkable to see.
Preserving the film will ensure that many can continue learning about the Buffalo's history. The grant process has taught special collections about ways to preserve non-paper materials and that they'll have to be selective in what they choose to preserve using modern methods.
We see that it's expensive, and you can't do that for every last item. It has helped us understand what we need for our physical environment, for storage. I've learned that it's better that things are kept cool. If you have a choice of relative humidity or of temperature, if you can keep things cold, that's a good thing. And we know that we will take as good a care as we can of the remastered film once it's back. But so the whole process has helped us learn into it and is a first piece of the, you know, of what we can do for maintaining our collections in a prudent way.
The remastering of the film will coincide with the processing of the papers of the Ozark Society and Special Collections for the commemoration next year of the 50th anniversary of the founding of the Ozark Society and the 40th anniversary of the establishment of the Buffalo National River. August of 2012 will also mark the 100th anniversary of Neil Compton's birth. More information is available at libinfo.uark.edu/specialcollections.
Neil Compton's name is synonymous with the Buffalo River. And another chronicler of the region, Tim Ernst, will be on our program Tuesday to talk about his latest book of Arkansas photography, The Skill of Waterfall Hunting, and how an iconic Ozarks location turned into a one-of-a-kind ice sculpture.
And if you look closely at this picture at the top of it, there's actually light that is illuminating the top of the ice, and it gives it a kind of a blue glow, which doesn't reach all the way down to the bottom of the column. But when I walked over and tapped on the column, it was kind of hollow in some places. Mm. So some of that light beam was reaching down in there, which was kind of neat.
Tim Ernst, Tuesday on Ozarks at Large on KUAF 91.3 FM.
This is Ozarks at Large. As mentioned earlier on the program, Arkansas voters delivered overwhelming approval yesterday for a plan to improve interstate highways in the state. The highway bonds, funded by an already existing 4-cent diesel tax, will generate about $575 million for repairs. Several interchanges along Interstate 540 will be improved or widened as part of the work. Nearly 80% of those voting cast ballots in favor of the measure.
The Arkansas Department of Human Services says it doesn't have a procedure to monitor church and state issues in preschools that receive state money. The issue has been raised after a controversy involving a Washington County preschool, Growing God's Kingdom. A complaint was filed that the school was receiving state money and teaching religious lessons. The preschool in question received more than $500,000 in Arkansas Better Chance taxpayer funds this year. Amy Webb, a spokesperson for DHS, says the department is in the process of writing up guidelines that employees can use in the future.
In response to the complaint from Americans United, our attorneys are doing some legal research so that they can give some more specific guidance to our staff in terms of what they need to be looking for when they go out to the ABC providers.
Webb says the department is in the process of also deciding how best to deal with the current issues raised by the complaint.
We sent out a employee on Friday to make observations at the center. And then once our attorneys provide some guidance, our Division of Child Care and Early Childhood Education will meet and discuss the observations that were made on Friday and decide whether any corrective action is needed. And if so, they will then contact the facility owners and discuss that corrective action with them.
That complaint was raised by the national group Americans United for the Separation of Church and State.
Friday is Veterans Day, and the first class in the Arkansas Military Veterans Hall of Fame will be inducted that night. One of the organizers of the hall says the concept is to give veterans in the state recognition.
Category 1 consists of veterans who were nominated for valor, that is, for what they did in combat. Category 2, because of the service they it could be that you have a veteran who, for whatever reason, never served in because there was not one while they were serving. From 1953, a couple of hot spots didn't have wars. And therefore, there has to be a mechanism.
Friday ceremonies will take place in Conway. The Hall of Fame will eventually be located at the state capitol.
Replicas of ships that sailed with Columbus on his expeditions from Spain will float into Fort Smith later this week. Copies of the Nina and Pinta will dock at Daly's Fleeting Service on Riverfront Drive and remain there until their departure early Monday morning. The Nina was built by hand and without the use of power tools and is considered to be the most historically correct Columbus replica ever built. The public can board the ships beginning Friday morning. There will be a fee assigned to tour the ships.
This reminder, a national emergency alert system test is scheduled to take place at 1 this afternoon. Every radio and TV station, including KUAF, will participate in the test that is expected to last about 3 minutes.
That'll be right after this program. The Arkansas Razorback men's basketball team won its final warm-up contest last night in Fayetteville. The Razorbacks defeated Christian Brothers 76-54. The regular season will open Friday night against South Carolina Upstate, a game in Bud Walton Arena.
The John Brown University men's basketball team is now 4-0 after defeating Baptist Bible College 94-38 last night. The JBU men next play Saturday in Siloam Springs against Central Baptist from Conway. The JBU women lost their season opener last night, 57-53, to Mid-America Nazarene in Olathe, Kansas.
Rain gardens can offset stormwater runoff, which contributes to water pollution. A Rain Garden Academy will take place tomorrow, November 10th at 9 a.m., sponsored by the Illinois River Watershed Partnership and Beaver Water District. This event will discuss the building of a rain garden, plus the quality of local waterways. Register or receive more information at IRWP.org.
It's Wednesday, November 9th, 2011. This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
I'm Kyle Kellums.
And joining us now is Becca Bacon-Martin, features editor from Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
You know, I remember when we started this and we worried that we wouldn't have things on weekdays.
Mm-hmm.
We never worry about that anymore.
That is not a problem.
Tonight, another edition of the Flying Tomato Cabaret.
Northwest Arkansas Community College.
Chamber Singers, a fundraiser for them. It's Singing Waiters. No, they don't throw tomatoes. It starts at 7 o'clock at the Walmart Auditorium in the Shoemaker Center. Tickets are $17. You get food. You get music.
Spaghetti? Is spaghetti part of this? Or am I imagining that? Am I just wishing spaghetti
into
my life?
I think spaghetti is part.
So
okay.
Or yeah. It was at one point.
Yeah.
Call 619-2237 and find out.
Okay.
Also tonight, Artistry of the Guitar. With Ken Bonfield and Steve Davison, it happens at 7:30 at George Dombeck's studio.
Yes.
Out in Goshen. You know, he's on this open studio thing mm-hmm. this month, and it's no wonder. He's got pieces at Crystal Bridges. He's mm-hmm. got darn near a whole wing at Tyson Corporate.
If you go to the Crystal Bridges Trail, mm-hmm. look up.
Yeah, that's his
bicycle. It's not easy to see. It's not easy to see. And then once you see it, it's just wonderful.
I was at Tyson Foods the other day talking about their art collection, and he's got darn near his whole wing. Did you know they've got 24 Warhols?
I didn't know they had 24.
24.
They have some Donald Harrington, too.
Yes, they do. Amazing stuff. Which has nothing to do with the price of tea here.
That's right.
$10 to get into the guitar thing tonight at George Dombeck's studio. It's if you're going to do it with your magic car. It's 844 Blue Springs Road in Fayetteville. Mm-hmm. It's actually in Goshen. You can call 501-425-1528 to find out more.
Sounds like a lot of fun. Thanks, Becca.
Becca Bacon-Martin is features editor at Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
And in just a moment, Michael Baker Brown, Judd Burns, Roger Hawk, and Jason Howell Smith, collectively known as 540 Express, will sing inside the Furman Garner Performance Studio. They'll also perform Sunday night at 5 at St. Paul's Episcopal Church in downtown Fayetteville. A preview of that concert just ahead on Ozarks at Large. This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums.
I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
We are inside the Furman Garner Performance Studio along with four gentlemen who call themselves 540 Express. Michael, Judd, Roger, and Jason, welcome.
Hi.
Thanks for having us.
540 Express because the highway connects the four of you?
Yes, and that we drive all over Northwest Arkansas to perform. Mm-hmm.
Now, Jason, I have talked to you almost a year ago. About a cappella singing.
Yes.
That was with another ensemble.
Right.
Anacrusis.
Uh-huh.
So you obviously love this form of music.
Yes. A cappella is something, once you start singing it, it's addictive. And not just that, if you have the right singers, you can sing it anywhere. It doesn't require lugging instruments. You have to be able to find a starting pitch, but that's why we have Judd, who's we call him our pitch pipe.
Well, let's talk to the pitch pipe. Judd?
Yes.
When did you begin singing?
Well, I began singing probably in about the second grade at church Christmas choirs and whatnot, what have you. And I really didn't get seriously into music until about my junior and senior year of high school. And these guys picked me up in about August and said, look, we really need a strong tenor to help us sing in this quartet. And I said, well, okay, I'll do it. I guess so.
It's because we tricked you into doing
it. Yeah, they tricked me into
we
it.
Him. We took him to dinner.
Oh.
But I wouldn't look back. I love it more than anything.
So how did you guys all meet each other? You say you picked him up.
Well, Roger and I went to the University of Arkansas, and Judd goes there currently, and we sang in Schola Cantorum at the university. And through various events and things like that at the Walton Arts Center, we had met Jason a few times. And so just through all these different performances and different venues and different events, we came to know each other and formed this bond between each other of this love of music that we have. And that's where why we got together and wanted to create what we're creating now.
You all mentioned that you love singing, and this is perhaps impossible to explain to someone who doesn't sing, but what is it about singing?
It's just a personal connection to the music that you can't really get otherwise. I mean, what makes singing so great is that you're actually saying words with notes and with phrases and what have you, as opposed to just playing notes and kind of trying to figure out what's going on. It's more you can think more about what the music is about and actually express it and say exactly what the music is about. And then putting together just more organically how the chords kind of fall together and these great lines is just, there's not really a feeling like it, especially when you're singing in giant cathedrals in Europe.
Yeah, absolutely. I think when you have voices that know, that are trained well, and you can put them together, there's a way that voices tune together that no instrument, I think, can.
And you guys have mentioned singing with larger groups, different ones around in the area. Is it more difficult singing with just four people?
It is. Well, it's more difficult, but it's more satisfying. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's easier. It's easier to line up your consonants. You can watch each other, and phrase together more easily than if you have 12 people or 24 people or 36 people. It becomes more difficult because everybody has to be aware of everybody. But if there's only one voice per part, if I screw up, I'll raise my hand and say, that was me, guys.
Yeah, you we're all accountable for our mistakes and everything.
Yeah,
too,
we are all accountable for our mistakes in a one voice per part, which is really kind of fantastic. You know, in fact, sometimes on days that we're learning music, we make so many mistakes that all we do is laugh and play most of the day.
Michael Baker Brown and I have some trouble with our giggle fits trying to move on with music.
It's this guy. He's got a lack of focus. I don't know.
You do not lack for an eclectic mix of music that is scheduled for the concert Sunday evening at 5. Renaissance, Toy Story, James Taylor, The Beatles.
Yes,
it spans a few centuries.
Mm-hmm.
Just a few.
I give credit, a lot of the credit to the music selection goes to Roger, because he comes to us with a full background of barbershop, but it's not just barbershop, it's men's quartet arrangements that he really kind of understands, which is very helpful to have on the ground. I think each of us have, you know, Judd can sit at a piano and write a song very easily. I tend to know church music quite well. And Michael Baker Brown, of course, being our educator, can tell you what kids can do in a heartbeat. So everyone brings different skills, but our rep is really kind of I give credit to Roger for finding most of it for us.
Thanks.
Well, let's hear what Four Voices can do. Should remind folks the concert is Sunday evening from 5 until 6 at St. Paul's Episcopal Church. That's downtown Fayetteville. Public welcome. Right?
Public welcome.
Absolutely. Come on.
All right.
Do, 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 do. Shoo, do, shoo, me, do. Ba, do, do. Shoo, do, shoo, me, do. Ba, do, do. Shoo, do, shoo, me, do. Ba, do, do. Shoo, do, shoo, me, do. In the still of the night, I held you tight. I remember the night in May.
precious love.
Your precious love.
So before the light, hold me again with all of your might in the still of the night.
In the still. Shoo-wop, 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 shoo-wop.
So before still of the night.
In the still of the night.
540 Express is Roger Hawk, Judd Burns, Jason Howell-Smith, and Michael Baker Brown. They'll perform a one-hour concert at St. Paul's Episcopal Church in Fayetteville Sunday at 5 p.m. You can hear more from them online at ozarksatlarge.com. And you'll be able to hear another song from them Sunday morning at 9 on Weekend Ozarks at Large.
And time now for a question. And the winner today will receive two tickets to any Malco movie theater in the area, two tickets to see the Water Coolers on Sunday afternoon at Aaron Arts Center in Bentonville. Water Coolers, a five-piece singing group. And then also a Tim Ernst 2012 calendar. Tim Ernst was here yesterday. That conversation will be on Tuesday, Ozarks Large. He left some calendars to give away as well. So tickets to the Water Coolers, Malco Movie Theater, and a calendar. Ready for the question?
Mm-hmm.
105 years ago today, President Teddy Roosevelt became the first sitting U.S. president to make an official trip outside of the country.
Okay.
What country did he visit on this venture?
All right.
Was it Mexico? Was it Panama? Was it Great Britain?
If you know or you have a guess, give us a call at 800-522-5823. That's 800-522-KUAF.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Wednesday. It's the 9th of November, 2011. It's the birthday of Carl Sagan, born Brooklyn, New York, 1934, who created the TV show Cosmos, still the most popular science program ever produced for television. He did a great deal to promote space exploration. He was also the one who convinced NASA to carry cameras on the Viking, Voyager, and Galileo missions, giving us photographs of the planets and their moons. He also persuaded NASA engineers to turn the Voyager 1 spacecraft around on Valentine's Day 1990, so that it could take a picture of Earth from the very edge of the solar system, about 4 billion miles away, a photograph in which Earth appears as a tiny bluish speck. It's the anniversary of Kristallnacht, the night in 1938 when German Nazis coordinated a nationwide attack on Jewish homes, businesses, and synagogues. Hitler and Joseph Goebbels ordered stormtroopers around the country to attack Jewish buildings but make the attacks look like spontaneous demonstrations. The police were told not to interfere. Firefighters were told only to put out fires in adjacent properties. More than 1,000 synagogues were burned. Rioters looted about 7,500 Jewish businesses, hospitals, homes, schools, and cemeteries. Many of the attackers were neighbors of the victims. The event was used to justify barring Jews from schools, most public places, forcing them to observe new curfews. And thousands were sent to concentration camps afterward. It was on this day in 1989, the leader of the East German Communist Party made an announcement, quietly, that the Berlin Wall would be opened for private trips abroad. And within days, millions of East Germans flooded into West Berlin, began to pull the wall to pieces. It's the birthday of the poet Anne Sexton, born Newton, Massachusetts, 1928, author of The Starry Night, The Book of Folly, The Awful Rowing Toward God. Anne Sexton, who said, "I wonder if the artist ever lives his life. He is so busy recreating it." And it's the birthday of the Irish playwright Hugh Leonard, born in Dublin, 1926, best known for his autobiographical play, Daw, 1973, later made into a movie starring Bernard Hughes and Martin Sheen. Here's a poem for today by Scott Poole, entitled The Bible. Just in case, it's over there, because you have to have at least one. The part I read the most is the inscription to my wife's grandmother. I imagine God at a book signing, signing her copy. "Dear Eva, thanks for worshiping." But mainly, I consider when she may have held it in her hands. A few times at church, a couple of confused moments in the bedroom, and one strange time after Mass, when she walked to the grocery store and set it for a few seconds on a stack of apples while she inspected the bananas for bruises. The Bible, a poem by Scott Poole, from The Sliding Glass Door, published by Colonus Publishing, and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by the Poetry Foundation, where your mobile device can turn into a virtual poetry library with the Poetry Foundation's Poetry app. You can find it online at poetryfoundation.org. And by Constant Contact, helping small businesses use email marketing with social media to reach more customers in more places. Online at constantcontact.com. Edited by Noah Smith and written by Betsy Allister. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
Time for the answer to our question.
Mm-hmm.
The question was, 105 years ago today,
yes,
President Theodore Roosevelt became the first sitting U.S. president to make an official visit outside the country. And I asked, which country did he visit? Was it Mexico, Panama, or Great Britain? You knew the answer.
Yes, Panama.
And why did he go?
Panama Canal.
Yes, he was visiting. He was checking up on the progress mm-hmm. of the creation of the Panama Canal. All correct answers go into the ceramic cow. And one winner will be pulled out of that at random. And you'll receive two tickets to any Malco movie theater in the area,
mm-hmm.
a Tim Ernst 2012 calendar, and two tickets to see the Water Coolers Sunday, presented by Live on Stage in NWA.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a show, music. It's created by one of the people who created the hit Tony and Tina's Wedding.
Yes, if you've ever seen that. I'll have a conversation with one of the cast members on tomorrow.
There you go. All right. Support for KUAF comes from Clubhouse Fitness and Health Club, now offering Clubhouse Complete Weight Loss. This program includes meal planning, weekly accountability, nutritional products, plus group classes and health education. Located on Dixon Street in Fayetteville, clubhausfitness.com for more information.
This is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Rogers, Fort Smith, Bear Creek Springs.
Where is Bear Creek Springs?
Northwest of Harrison.
Huh.
Yep.
All right. Never been there, I don't think. Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF. I'm Kyle Kellums.
I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
Ithi Agnihotri-Madulker joins me tomorrow. You and I will be live Friday in Bentonville.
Yes, we will.
For Veterans Day and Crystal Bridges opening ceremonies.